Welcome to the Somatic Primer Podcast with Bryson, an ongoing cross-discipline dialogue of all things somatics.
Hello, welcome to the Somatic Primer Podcast. I'm Bryson Newell, your host. Before we begin, I'd like to remind listeners again if they could go to our website, somaticprimer.com, make a donation, one time or monthly, either way, we greatly appreciate it. Help support the show. On today's show, I had the pleasure to sit down with Alex Stringmore. Alex has over 20 years experience as a practitioner in Qigong, Tai Chi, and meditation. He's also trained in acupuncture and bodywork. He spent many years in Vietnam studying traditional medicine and Dien Chan, or Vietnamese facial reflexology. Alex has a new book out called Facial Reflexology and for Emotional Well-Being that you can find on his website. I'll leave a link to his website to see his find out more about him, his online classes, and if you're interested in getting a copy of his book. All right, and now my conversation with Alex Stringmore. Hi, Alex. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here. Good to speak with you.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we could start with your background a little bit. So tell us maybe who you are and how you got started on this path.
Sure. Yes. So yeah, I'm born and bred in London, and from a young age, I started becoming very interested in shamanism, Qigong when I was a teenager. Eventually, that led me to studying acupuncture. Mm-hmm. That was about 15 years ago or so.
In London?
Just outside of London, yeah. There's a big college in Reading, about an hour outside of London. So I was studying there for 3 years as a degree course and studying Tuina, Chinese massage. And then I was very lucky during that time to have a mentor who originally trained in Vietnam and said, you have to go and work in the hospitals to get enough needling skill. So kind of pushed me out the door, and I was very lucky to make a connection with one of the big hospitals out in Saigon. So I went out there, and yeah, I think that's the one thing that's a little bit difficult with the Western acupuncture training is that there's not as much hands-on work in the clinical years in China or Vietnam, where you're really, you know, you're maybe treating, you know, 30 people a day or something. So mainly for the needling skills, that's really helpful. That was 2012, and really wonderful experience to see acupuncture and herbs and Qigong being used in the hospital. Also found some amazing teachers in Dien Chan out there, which is what I've come to specialize in now, which is Vietnamese face reflexology. I had a practice in London the last 12 or so years. And recently I've shifted to working abroad. Like I was just saying before, the last year I've gone fully nomadic, and I'm just working in different countries, mainly with hotels and luxury spas, mainly out in Asia as well. So I've just come back from Indonesia. It's slightly, I would have never imagined I would have ended up working, you know, in spas, but it's actually a wonderful setting to give treatments where people are already primed to settle, and you know, very relaxing environments, which I think really helps with the treatments. And yeah, my speciality is doing face reflexology, Dien Chan, and also incorporate different body work and massage and acupuncture as well into the treatments.
So you threw out a couple different things there, so maybe we can pause and reverse and unpack these. So you have acupuncture and then Tuina.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if everybody will know what Tuina is, or even acupuncture. Maybe we could sort of go, because I know there's different types of acupuncture.
It's a whole minefield.
Yeah.
So Yeah, the training I did in the UK was at the College of Integrated Chinese Medicine. And in the West, acupuncture first came in the 70s, really, properly. And in the UK, there was a teacher called J.R. Worsley, who he was really the main teacher back in the 70s. And he developed what he called five element or constitutional acupuncture. And this was from his teachers in Taiwan and also from influences in Vietnam and Japan. And then in the 80s, people started coming back from China and teaching the Chinese style of acupuncture, which has kind of come to be called TCM, traditional Chinese medicine. And the college I studied at had an integrated approach using the TCM Chinese style alongside the five element style. But what you find is, there's different approaches in Korea, in Japan, in Vietnam. And it's a little bit tricky. I think it's one of the main misunderstandings about acupuncture is that people see it as one kind of complete form of therapy, whereas it's actually traditionally been a very pluralistic therapy. There's all these different ways of doing it, kind of like massage. There's many different ways of doing massage. They all have their kind of foundation in the classics of Chinese medicine. But you get a lot of contrasting ways of doing it, and you go to a Chinese acupuncturist, and it tends to be fairly strong, and you can really feel the needles. This is a generalization, of course. And if you go to a Japanese acupuncturist, they tend to be very, you won't feel the needles at all. And part of that's just the kind of culture as well. People expect to feel the needles in China, whereas in Japan, if you feel the needles, you're considered a bad acupuncturist. So there's, yeah, a lot of different cultural timelines that have gone on. And then in the West as well, as we've slowly learned more and more and put all the different pieces together, you could say there's actually a Western approach to acupuncture now as well. So there's a big mix there. And the history, it's really complex. It's hard to get your head around when you first start studying. So it took me a while to get my head around all of it. And what people tend to find is after some years in practice, you develop your own approach or own way of practicing. And at the same college, I studied Tui Na, which is basically using all the same theory as acupuncture, the acupuncture points and the channels and organ theory and channel theory, but just using your hands and massage techniques instead of needles. And they can be quite complementary, and sometimes acupuncture you might say is more suited with some internal issues, whereas massage can be more appropriate for some more external kind of injury type issues. Again, that's a big generalization. But yeah, it's over the years I studied Tui Na, but also many different kinds of massage, Thai massage, deep tissue massage, reflexology, Mayan abdominal massage. Yeah, so I've started developing really my own way of practicing. I think that's often the case. People find their own way of doing it. But it can lead to some issues when from one acupuncturist to the next, it can be a totally different experience. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've experienced that. And it seems like the acupuncture, so like here, if you get, you go to a doctor, you get a prescription. The prescription's the same thing, no matter which doctor you go to. But with acupuncture, it seems to be most based on the person's skill level also, because it's such a, just like a massage, it's like somebody give you one, somebody better or worse, they give you some different experience. So it's not
Yeah.
so objective. We always want something repeated results. Like I go to McDonald's, I get the same hamburger every time. These things are just aren't like that.
No, and I think that goes to the heart of the medicine as well. It's very changeable, and it's all based on change. Seeing the body and everything is in continuous change, and there's very much a kind of holistic, individualized approach. So it makes it very hard to do research because you'll get 10 people with seemingly the same back pain, but actually from a Chinese medicine perspective, the causes can all be different for each person. And then the points you'd use, the treatment would also be different as well. So it's quite hard to standardize. But actually that's what, over the years, there has been this kind of push because of that challenge to standardize the medicine. And the main point in history was in the 1950s, where instead of abandoning the traditional medicine, you know, that like they were abandoning everything else in traditional culture, they decided to kind of standardize it so it could be taught in universities en masse and also practiced in hospitals to the extent that everyone kind of is on the same page and is doing a similar kind of thing. So yeah, this is where the TCM style really emerged, is from that big push in the 1950s.
And how's that working?
There was some very skilled people who were behind that. So it worked quite well, definitely. So it could be, you know, used en masse. But a lot of people say that it also watered down some aspects of it, and it stripped out the more spiritual side of it. The emotional side of it was sidelined or kind of banished in some people's size. And so, yeah, I think, it's complex. There's some amazing practitioners doing TCM style acupuncture. But also I think it's, you know, if you look at how it's done in China in the hospitals, there are certain things where they would default to Western medicine. And that wasn't always the case. And acupuncture tends to be, you know, it's the same thing. If you have a stroke there, you know, you'd go to the emergency care first, but in the rehab, you'd go to the acupuncture clinic. So, you know, it's got its pros and its cons, the TCM style.
Well, I was more thinking just trying to standardize something like this. Can it really be? Is it still going to be dependent upon the person? You know, there's still a skill technique. It would seem that you, no matter how hard you tried, it would still have to incorporate the individual.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, you know, like I said, its nature is very changeable. So, you know, you're never really going to be able to squeeze it in a box that much.
right. And then the other question that occurs to me is that how much does the person getting the treatment play into the treatment? So is this just like one-sided, like the acupuncturist is doing something to you, or the person that it's being done, getting the treatment, is actually a participant? And how does that play out in their health? Like, are they passive or an active participant, I guess?
I think it's a big mix. And again, dependent on who you go and see. But, you know, traditionally they would say the doctor is the medicine, and the idea of placebo biology, you know, that wasn't considered like some kind of bad thing, but actually was utilized by doctors to help as well. But at the same time, you know, it does have, a very tangible effect. And so it is a bit of a kind of mix between the participation of the client, the patient, and the doctor. So, yeah, I mean, the research I've done for the book I just wrote, you know, I've gone a lot into the kind of relational aspects of health, the kind of social dimension. And, you know, to be in a state of healing, your body needs to relax. You can't be in the fight or flight mode, really. This is why most healing happens when we're asleep. So if you want to shift someone into that mode, you need to convey a sense of safety. And also a big part of that is the kind of connection you have face to face and with your voice. And so I think the best doctors do have a very good bedside manner. They are able to really put their patients at ease, even without doing anything. I think that's a big part of any kind of doctor's art. But yeah, it can go a lot further as well. You know, I think it's not just a case of tuning someone into you know, the a calm state of the nervous system, I think there is also other factors that are going on behind the scenes there that are perhaps a bit more mysterious.
Well, so that's interesting. So I would think, like, yeah, helping somebody relax would be the first stage. But then, like, for somebody like you, if you were getting the treatment, like, you know all of these meridians, you know all this information, like, would you, as being an active participant in the treatment, you would be able to enhance your own treatment?
Yeah.
Well, you talk in your book a lot about, and so this is something I'm really interested in, is in embodiment and being disembodied.
So
I would imagine, like what you're saying, putting somebody in a relaxed state, we're moving into a more embodied state of being. And there's
absolutely
different... yeah so go ahead.
Yeah I think that's there's so many different dimensions to it, embodiment and disembodiment, and I feel setting them up, you know, I wrote a chapter about it, but setting them up as a kind of one being bad, one being good is perhaps a too simplistic way to look at it. You know, everyone is talking about trying to be embodied, but I think getting in touch with the way we disembody as well as part of that process, and to shift between them is the real mark of health, I think. Again, going back to how we heal in our sleep, to be able to shift into that disembodied state of sleep is a really healthy thing. But, you know, if we're tuned out of our body and we're not in touch with what's going on, that can be a mark of ill health as well. So, it's a kind of complex dynamic that's at play there. But absolutely, when we relax, when we can really slow down and settle into our feeling of the body, as you know, it's kind of obvious, this will make us feel more embodied.
Yeah, so I agree with you. I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, so when I talk to some Tai Chi practitioners, Qigong, Shaolin practitioners, and, you know, when they enter into an embodied state, but there's still there's an awareness in that state. And so they can move and guide sensations from that embodied state. So they're not disembodied just cognitively. So you're not laying on the table thinking, oh, I got a meeting tomorrow, and just getting the treatment, but they're not really present, versus being present and working with the treatment from an embodied state, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I see what you mean now. I think, yeah, being able to be present with the treatment, with what's actually happening, with where the hands are placed, with where the needles are placed, that's a huge part of the healing effect, for sure. And, you know, when you place a needle into the body, people can't not feel it. And it really summons the awareness to that area in the body. So I think, you know, when you're, you know, a lot of people don't really spend that much time feeling into their back, but if you place a needle into the back, people can suddenly feel what's going on inside their back. So I think that's part of the function of acupuncture, is kind of reawakening someone to the inside of their self.
So we get this idea of channels, meridians, points, and we look at them in a book or on a, you know, something on a screen or something, and, you know, they're drawn in kind of linear fashion, and they're always going to be drawn like kind of on the surface, because, right, it's hard to get the three dimensions. So can you sort of give us a map of, like, what this real, like, what's the anatomy of this? Like, how should we try to contextualize this and see this?
You're right. You know, when you look at everything on the surface, it's obviously not, the channels aren't just lying on top of the body. They're inside the body as well. And there's different, if you look at the anatomy of the acupuncture points, there's different depths for each point as well. So one way of looking at it is kind of like, you know, there's just many layers inside the body, layers to the body, and there's different channel networks at each layer. And, you know, you've got the superficial layers, you know, the what they call the sinew channels, or the tendo muscular channels, which kind of, you know, has seems to have a big overlap with the fascia and the muscles and the skin. And that's perhaps more what you're engaging in with massage. And then there's channels that run deeper in the body as well, which you're tapping into with needles. And then, you know, at the, you know, the heart of things, there's kind of these deep reservoirs of energy, the what they call the extraordinary channels, and the organs as well, you know, the heart and the kidneys and so on. So I think, yeah, it's an interesting one, because when you look at the maps as well, I wrote about this in the book about how we can kind of see the body by breaking it down into all its little parts, into the anatomy, and analyzing the body. And that way of thinking about our body and seeing the body is, it's a little bit disconnected from what's really happening there. And I love this term, the felt body. And when you practice Qigong or Tai Chi or any of the you know, meditative arts where you're really engaging on the inside, you're really tuning into the felt body. And that is actually quite different from the anatomical body. Because if you look in the anatomy books, everyone's got actually slightly different, you know, shaped, you know, colons and whatnot. And it's the same with the channels as well. So this is why palpation and actually feeling into the body when you're working, I think it's a huge, huge help, because the points do shift, you know, the channels do slightly shift as well. And, you know, I think that's, again, going back to the heart, it's all changing, it's all growing, it's all in the state of flux. Yeah.
And so there's these different layers of channels. So, and again, we see, like, you know, there's 12, however many, but the way you're describing them, I got more of a background in Tibetan medicine. The way they perceive the channels, they're like every single pore of the skin has a channel. It's just like this infinite array of channels. It's not real clear cut. And so there's different. So then this would lead us to levels of embodiment. We can get deeper and deeper in our practice through superficial, like you said, we can go all the way down and try to work with these deeper levels that, you know, but like they're not like graspable things. Like I'm not with my, you know, with a bone per se. It's much more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's much more changeable. That energetic aspect of the body. It's interesting because it's connected into the physical, you know, the real matter of the body, but it's also in the kind of level of consciousness of awareness as well. So there's that kind of mix there, which you don't have in Western medicine. And you're right, the same kind of thing you could say in acupuncture, every point on the body could be seen as an acupuncture point. You know, if it's, if there's a tenderness, you know, if it's alive, they call it an asha point, and it has a therapeutic potency. And this is the same with the face as well, with facial reflexology. Every single point on the face you could see as, you know, being a living and active point. And it's just down to actually whether there's a difference in sensitivity. You know, if it's especially tender, that seems to kind of trigger the best effect.
Well, I mean, you hit on a good point, I think, is the idea of consciousness. So in the West, we're not really talking about consciousness when we talk about anatomy. It's like, yeah, it's in, you know, dualistic separate things, where I've always looked at the channels as like, this is the inroads, or this is the conscious representation in the body, or the alive quality of the body, right? Some, you know, a way to interact with the body. I don't know how you want to say it from the Western view. It makes sense from the Eastern perspective, but the Western, I have a hard time trying to think about it from that point of view.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's one of those kind of background assumptions we all have, that the body is the body and the mind is the mind, and they are separate domains. And yeah, in the book, I really, to be honest, and in my own life, I've been slowly trying to untangle or kind of reunite this connection between mind and body. And a big part of that is how we understand emotions and stress. You know, is it a physical thing? Is it something that's in the mind, or is it something that's in the nervous system? And yeah, more and more, I'm trying to shift into, you know, actually what a lot of the heart of these, you know, older traditions are saying, that actually consciousness and awareness is really the kind of field that everything else is belonging in. And it's the, if you can kind of work at that level, everything else will shift and adjust. So yeah, there's this old saying, I think it's a wonderful article by Heiner Fuhrhoff, where he titles the essay, all diseases come from the heart. And the heart in Chinese medicine is the kind of the house of the mind. It's really it's kind of cinnamon for the mind, the heart. So yeah, there's this very and I think this is one of the things that the standardization in the 50s kind of filtered out, is really this understanding that if you treat the person, if you treat them as a being, as a kind of conscious being, then all the that will create this trickle down effect through all the physicality of, and all the symptoms will vanish. So that's the, and in a way, this is the five element approach. They're not concerned with any of the physical symptoms, really. It's maybe like, you know, a small detail. They're just trying to get into the character of the person, you know. So that, yeah, so it's a very different way of working. And it has incredible results, but I think it can be tricky to really hit the bullseye every time. You have to be very skilled to only work through the mind and heal the body that way.
I mean, that's such a radical departure or perspective. You know, I feel like if we just continue to look at Eastern medicine or Eastern practices with this disembodied body and mind split, like, it's just not really even possible to see. Fundamentally, it's set up from the other side.
Yeah. It's one of these, it's kind of like the water we swim in. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also, there's a level of skepticism and kind of even mockery when you start talking about the power of the mind or even, you know, the power of the spirit. A lot of people will switch off, especially if they've got a life-threatening disease they're dealing with. But I think that's really, you know, more and more, this is really the crux of where I think, you know, medicine really needs to shift. And, you know, our whole understanding of consciousness seems to be shifting in this way as well, where we're not in a kind of physicalist world, that everything's just matter and the mind is just this kind of strange thing that seems to be happening in human brains, but has a much, much greater role to play both in the world and in biology. So yeah, I think we were talking a little bit about McGilchrist before we started, but he's a wonderful, wonderful articulator of all these ideas, you know, the shift into idealism, looking at the whole world as conscious. Also, I'm hugely inspired by a fellow called Bernardo Kastrup, who is he's kind of like he's supremely logical and rational, and he's a scientist, an engineer, but he just completely destroys the argument that everything in the world is physical at its fundamental nature. So he argues for idealism. And he's a really inspiring guy. And that has given me the confidence in a way to, you know, look again back into Chinese medicine and how I'm working and, you know, really trying to engage on that level more. Because, yeah, like you said, I think it is one of those assumptions we all have, and it's pervasive. You know, it's really one of the big conditioning things about our culture. This kind of shift into individualism, and it changes how we're embodied as well. You know, it kind of, I think it's one of the big things that really gives this feeling of isolation in our bodies from everything else, that our mind is completely contained inside our skull. And if you start to, you know, feel into, oh, maybe, you know, there's more of a kind of blend in my experience between inside and outside my body, it's a wonderful thing to lean into. So
yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I think that's really interesting. So this idea of embodiment, when we become embodied, we're not contained. We're actually become interconnected. There's more sense of being interconnected with the environment. There's like a listening, I think. And it's like, again, we kind of want to place it. Oh, embodiment, disembodiment, inside or out or something like this. It's like it's too linear still. That it's more like a shift of awareness. Like, are you in like a listening state, or are you in a talking, doing state? Like it's not so clear what this means actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I love what you said there. I think I've been reading this fellow called Henry Corbin lately, and just this morning I was reading about how when you do go inside, it does open you at the outside. There's a kind this kind of you know, there's this saying, as above, so below. But I think that you can also apply, you know, if you go within, you also, you can connect into the whole world as well outside. So there's something kind of mystical there. but yeah, the idea of feeling really boundaried, you know, really embodied, I feel like that's totally not what embodiment should be.
Not be what we're saying.
Yeah, feel like opening the boundaries so you can really, you know, feel embedded and real connected. But I think, you know, again, it's quite complex, and it's quite so easy to stumble over words with this, because it, you know, I think our language is set up to, it frames things in one way already, and to kind of point towards and get into a different way of being in the body where it's more relational, it's a hard shift to make. And I think also when there are, you know, if you look at all the kind of shift into being trauma informed, and the whole kind of this blossoming of awareness about mental health and trauma over the last few years, there is a delicate dance to play, you know, when people are really dissociating from their body, or have like, you know, quite severe, you know, strange symptoms of feeling disembodied or feeling disconnected. It's actually, I think there's so many different roads you can walk down, and some need to take a much slower than others. So I think the idea of just taking away all the boundaries and trying to merge with the world, it's not always helpful for everyone as well.
So this brings me to an interest. So a way of mapping consciousness or thoughts. So McGilchrist, I think, has done a pretty good job, because he's like, well, we have concepts, we have a conceptual thoughts, and then we have more of a non-conceptual awareness. In Tibet and in Indian Buddhism, at least, there's clear maps of consciousness. But in Chinese, you know, coming from your background, I know we have like things like the yi, or we loosely translate to heart. Like, is there a mapping of consciousness, like what type of consciousness we're using, like the conceptual, non-conceptual? Has this all been mapped out for you in your training and your background?
I think there's a degree of mapping, yeah. But when I started my training through college, it's hard to make sense of it all, and it's quite alien, you know, when you're looking at the five shen, and there's the spirit of the liver, the hun, and this is connected to dreams, and then you've got the intention, and there's a kind of basic way of mapping it out, but it's really hard to embody that and to really get a felt sense of what that is, and so it stays conceptual for most people. And to be honest, I think even in China, you know, Western medicine is the default medicine, and by extension, you know, the physicalist way of seeing the world and everything is, that's also the default. So I think it's largely a conceptual thing there as well. when you look back at more the traditional way of seeing things or the classical way of seeing things, I think it's much more alive in people who are still in touch with those traditions. It's tricky, this mapping the soul. It's like I feel like, yeah, actually it's maybe the wrong way to go about it anyway. Like it's something that it there's a kind of wilderness out there that I think maybe it's also this kind of embodiment thing. It's tied into this where when you have an anatomical way of seeing the body or the mind, it actually closes you off to the felt sense of what's really there. And a big part of that is this sense of the unknown, of really not knowing what the mind really is, what it's really connected to. And so much of medicine is trying to banish that uncertainty and unknown, because people hate not knowing, if they're going to live or die. They really like to be told a clear answer about what's happening in their health. It's scary when you really just have to be with what's unknown. And I think, that this embodiment or the non-conceptual that you referred to, I think part of that is staying in touch with, what is beyond or everything that's known.
Okay, so maybe we can switch tracks here. So you said you really do a lot with fascia.
No, I mentioned it. I wouldn't say I'm a fascia specialist. No, I'm fascinated by fascia, its role in the body. I think, again, it's one of those things that's actually quite mysterious. I think we totally haven't got it figured out. Maiwan Ho, this researcher, I don't know if you've heard of Maiwan Ho. She's got some amazing research looking at the connection between fascia and acupuncture points and channels. Her book is called The Rainbow and the Worm, I think. And he's done a lot of studies showing how there's this big overlap, but also looking in, what do they call it, the liquid crystalline nature, and how that gives it some kind of a network effect through the whole body of fascia. It's a beautiful way of looking at the body, but for me, it's a bit of a mystery as well.
And I think it's an interesting thing because it's coming through the Western lens of anatomy, but it's taking us away from the Western view of anatomy in some ways. Because it stays a mystery. It's like, well, what is it? They were throwing it away for the majority of the time doing autopsies and stuff. So it's like, it's not so clear. You can't hold it in your hand all the time. It has a liquid quality. It can melt. It's seen as like wrapping. So it's quite interesting that it's moving us. So what I mean by the mapping of the consciousness, I think fascia sort of moves us in this direction. It's like, so we have our conceptual way of knowing things, right? You can say fascia, you can say bones and this, but then when you start to move into these, that the conceptual idea of your map begins to fall apart.
Yeah, the boundaries get blurred between one muscle and the next. And
So if we're starting from the conceptual point of view, it's helpful to have a map, but then understand the map's not the territory and jump, right? It's
absolutely
going to take you into this other thing, and that's just fine. So there's no fear and there's no sort of guesswork. It's like, you know where you're going, but the concept isn't going to hold.
Absolutely. I think, you absolutely need to have a solid understanding of anatomy, to work well with the body. It can be a stepping stone to the seeing the bigger picture. For me, I work a lot with the face and with face reflexology, and that's definitely the layer of the body I think I'm most engaged with. It's not going as deep as acupuncture. But what's interesting is, even though it seems kind of like a more superficial layer, it seems to, the effect seems to cascade deep into the body in a similar way to acupuncture. So it has this similar idea of the asha point, the active point, which is wherever there's an increased tenderness or even a this increased difference in sensation. Sometimes it can be a lack of sensation too. So when you work through the face and release or the point, it seems to release down into the body in a really interesting way. This is what I'm super fascinated in. And, you know, the book is a really deep dive into the connections between the face and the body and trying to, you know, integrate all that I've learned from Chinese medicine and Qigong, but also, you know, from the research into stress and trauma and the nervous system. So, yeah, trying to bring together those different modes of understanding the body.
So this is the Dian Chan.
But yeah, Dian Chan, it was developed in the 1970s, late 70s after the war. And originally they were using acupuncture needles on the face. He realized that, you know, actually was originally trialed in an addiction clinic and they were using it to help addicts. And he realized that it wasn't just working with those problems, but with other health issues, different kinds of pain in the body. And so the founder of Dian Chan, he's known as the professor or Bia Kwok Chow, he actually mapped out about 300 points on the face. And he realized you didn't need to have such a strong sensation as a needle to work, to have a good effect. So he started using massage tools and developed a number of massage tools to treat the face. And basically working with all the different Dian Chan points. And so you have typically a kind of protocol of maybe 5 or 10 points for certain kinds of digestive issues. Or if you've got shoulder pain, you'd work on certain points on the eyebrow. Or there's many different protocols to treat pretty much anything you can imagine. So this really, you know, it really stood out to me when I first went out there, because I thought of reflexology more of a kind of foot massage, like a really skilled person I've heard can help with back pain and this kind of thing. But in Vietnam, it's not at all like a relaxation treatment. People are sat face to face and the treatments are only 5-10 minutes. And they're treating everything, everything you can imagine. They're working with just kind of simple pains and aches and pains, and also with, you know, people with, you know, lung disease and diabetes, all sorts of things. So that, yeah, that really got my curiosity, and that's why I started trying to learn more and more. Eventually developing my own way of doing it, combining different kinds of body work. So instead of doing it face to face and just doing the points, I do a lot of hands-on work as well. And it's interesting. I think it seems to, when you release the face, it seems to shift the body into a state of relaxation that you can't get to if you just maybe release the foot or the back. There's something about the face that is very, very soothing. And I think it's like a real entryway into the deeper states of relaxation that you need to be in for healing.
So when you talk about the face, is it literally just the face, or is it like the head, the whole head, the ears, like the neck, the jaw? Like what are we really talking about?
The main points are just on the face, but there are some points on the head as well. And there's quite a few bigger, when they do treatment, they are also actually working on the body with different tools and with moxibustion. But it's mainly just on the face, yeah. So yeah, the work I do, I'm also working a lot around the neck. You know, I think, the connection between the head and the body, you know, it's really important to release this tension. We have everyone got tight shoulders and neck. And so I think that really helps with the treatment if you can, you know, integrate between the different parts of the body.
So why do you think it has such a profound effect on the rest of the bodies? I mean, so I've listened to, I don't know if you're familiar with Tom Myers, Anatomy Trained, and they do fascia. They're like, you can do really hard fascia work on the body, but when it comes to the face, you need to be really delicate because the fascia is more delicate. You can like injure the fascia if you're too hard. So it seems like you're saying a similar thing, like you don't need a hard treatment.
Well, yeah, I think, yeah, you're obviously not going it it can be pretty intense. I got to say, it can be pretty strong. But you're not, yeah, it's not like working on the feet. It is a lot more delicate, and it's a lot more sensitive work, a lot more detailed. And I think, yeah, like you said, it does seem to have a unique place in the body. If you think about it, it is kind of the most complex part of the body, like structurally. And if you look at the fascial planes, like, you know, Tom Myers, there's often this correspondence with the sinew channels or the tendon muscular channels. And all these channels actually, they start on the tips of the fingers and toes and run up in, and they all finish in the face, which is quite interesting. Yeah, and it's the same with all the yang channels of the body as well. They all coalesce up and around the sense organs, around the ears and the eyes, which is quite interesting. So
the face is yang?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, from the traditional understanding, you know, the yang is kind of, it's the top, it's the heavens, it's the sun. The yin is the earth, the lower parts of the body. So anything above is yang and below is yin. So the tendency, you know, with our culture is to have so much stimulation, to be over the yang, to be doing too much, to be too busy, and to have too much energy rising up into the head, and raising the shoulders. You know, this creates all these patterns of tension in the upper body. And so part of both Dian Chan and I think Qigong as well is this kind of ability to sink the qi, to settle the energy down from the head into the heart, into the belly. So this, I think, is a big part of what Dian Chan is doing. It's really able to sink the qi down and connect it, the head to the body. So often when, I think because some people, they think, oh, it's just a face treatment or it's a head treatment, but a big part of the effect really is to try and bring the energy down so you feel more connected. So when we release the face, this seems to make it much easier to feel into the heart, feel into the body.
What I was trying to get at, maybe I wasn't so clear, is with the embodiment. So it sounds like this is like the disembodiment of the senses, constantly externally stimulated. Everything's coming in the face, right? Most of our senses, sensory organs are located in the face and the head. Mm-hmm. And so when we can calm that down, as you say, sink the qi, I can maybe say our awareness or consciousness down. We can settle more into the center of the body, where we can be more embodied, connected in this way. So you're saying, like, so for practitioners of any embodiment tradition, this could be a massive help.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it can really help, you know, just with meditation. You know, it's an interesting thing how, you know, if you've done retreats, I found myself that, you know, you're trying to settle the body and to, you know, soften and relax. And sometimes you might notice that, oh, there's a little bit of holding in the face. And if you can soften the face, sometimes it can really help, you know, bring you, you know, down to stillness. But I think, yeah, with Qigong, what I found so fascinating is that there is a big overlap between the self-massage you do in Qigong for the face and the head and also the rest of the body and Dian Chan. So I think this is one of the influences that led to creating Dian Chan. Because, you know, there are a lot of these traditions where you're releasing the acupoints around the eyes, or you're palming over the eyes or rubbing the ears, all these different techniques to basically kind of clear the head. I think, yeah, it's like I just said, I think part of that is, you know, it helps create more flow. And you could say traditionally release any heat also as well. So if you look at the function of all the points, the main acupuncture points on the face or around the eyes, they tend to be for releasing heat or releasing wind. I think that's actually, you know, you could see it as, you know, there's too much heat with certain eye conditions or tinnitus and whatnot. But actually, that's it's also a kind of symbolic way of seeing emotions as well. Seeing heat as you know, pent up emotions, or wind as like this restlessness. And obviously, there is, you know, such a strong connection between the emotions and the face. So I think there's a strong aspect to it there as well, where when you release the tension in the face, or also releasing the emotion in the face, or let, maybe releasing is the wrong word, just letting it flow a bit more freely.
Hmm. Yeah, and our faces, so like you were saying earlier, the back, we might not have much sensation there. You put a needle in, you can feel a little something, but our face, we feel. If we pay attention, yeah, it's very sensitive. And so it can be a very good indicator of if we're overheated or what our emotional state is if we tune into it.
Absolutely. Well, it's an interesting one. I think you're right in that we have incredible amount of sensitivity in the face, you know, more so than anywhere else in the body, apart from maybe, you know, the thumbs, the hands. But it's interesting how we can disconnect from the feeling in our face, you know. And it's you just look at anyone who's really stressed, and they're not really kind of like aware that they're creating this tension in their face. And a lot of people say this when you work giving a treatment, people sometimes don't realize how much tension you're holding in your face until you actually touch it and you work to release it. So yeah, I feel like, yeah, there's something really interesting there. We've got these kind of these layers of tension, perhaps, or I think they're tied into the kind of masks, you know, the masks that we wear for different occasions.
I've sat in many classrooms and watched professors or teachers, and when they write on the board, or they do a certain thing, their face will do it before they even go to write or whatever. I would laugh at always time I'd sit and I'd be like, I know that face, I know what's coming. but they're not aware that they're doing these twisted things with their face as they engage in particular activities, and they repeat it, and I would always laugh. It's so funny.
Yeah, it's like a poker tell.
Yeah, poker tell.
yeah, and I think that's it. It's a kind of doorway into what's happening in the mind, you know. But also I think it's you know, you can shift into different modes of being or perception according to how you know, orientate with the face. And this is what I try, and this is kind of the aim of the book as well. It's a bit ambitious, but the last chapters, you know, they're really trying to look at how we can change our perception through, you know, shifting the mode of being, shifting into a more embodied state. Yeah, this I find completely fascinating. And it's one of those things where, you know, more and more we're starting to understand how, when we're in a state of stress and fear, fight or flight, we're actually seeing a different world. You know, we're what's salient, what's really, we're paying attention to the world in a way that we're really sometimes blanking out a lot of what's actually there. You know, the predictive aspect of the brain, you know, we're basically tuning out on what's unnecessary, and sometimes what's unnecessary is what's most beautiful. So when you're feeling safe and you're relaxed and you're feeling calm in the body and you feel more in your body, I think this changes your perception, so you can notice a different world around you. And yeah, this is the kind of goal of the book, is to try and what I call shift into an orientation towards beauty. So not just with nature and trying to notice, you know, the kind of little beautiful things around us, but with other people as well. I think, you know, when you can kind of shift into that more social, relaxed state, I think it's, you know, it's a big part of untangling all the strife we get into, and even a lot of the health issues we get into. It's often tied into basically the stress we've got in our different relationships. So yeah, it's an ambitious thing, but so far I've had good feedback from the book. So yeah, it's really wonderful.
Well, I don't want to take up any more of your time. Is there anything that you want to, that we didn't get to discuss, that you want to include?
No, it's just been a joy talking with you. I think we've touched on some pretty, for me, very fascinating topics. And I feel like with each area, you know, you can go deeper and deeper. And for me, it's just going to be fascinating looking at how much we're going to learn about all these aspects of you know, the relational, looking at how the mind really is playing a much bigger part in the body than we previously thought. Looking at how Dian Chan is going to spread as well, it's quite exciting. I feel like it's a lot of people starting to tune into these kind of self-care tools. So yeah, it's a really exciting time. So yeah, no, I really enjoy speaking with you. Thank you.